Hello, it's Wednesday the 25th of March. My name's John Dennis. Today, the new primary school curriculum is leaked to The Guardian. Out goes the Second World War and in goes Twitter and Wikipedia.
This is something that kids are already doing, so in a way it's the curriculum catching up with children.
Also today, Gordon Brown tours the world trying to drum up support for the G20 summit he's hosting in London next week. But British officials are trying to dampen expectations.
Well, it's interesting that Gordon Brown is now wrapping himself in the European flag because he got a bit of a reputation when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer of not exactly being wildly keen on the European Union.
And Nudge, remember that? Well, one of the authors of the economic theory that seemed to have been eclipsed by the collapse of the world's money markets says it's still very much in demand from Barack Obama and David Cameron.
The default option for the government is to grant all requests for information. So our big campaign for transparency is one that Obama agrees with.
But first, here's Bill Overton with the news and a flick through the papers.
The Prime Minister Gordon Brown's arrived in the US on the second day of a tour leading up to next week's G20 economic summit in London. He's hoping to build a consensus on reviving the world economy. Yesterday, he told European MEPs that he wanted a new morality in capitalism with tougher regulation and an end to tax havens. Today, he'll meet the UN Secretary General in New York and also a group of Wall Street financial leaders. In a news conference in Washington, the US president said he sees signs of economic recovery, but Americans need to be patient. Barack Obama's $3 trillion budget goes before Congress this week. He said that it would create new jobs and revive the housing market, and also that the G20 conference would involve a common goal of boosting economic growth and improving financial regulations. The Audit Commission says local councils negligently carried on depositing money in Icelandic banks after their credit rating had been downgraded just days before the banks collapsed. £33 million was deposited in the final days by local authorities, ranging from Kent and Havering in the southeast to South Yorkshire and Cleveland in the northeast. The Commission said that these authorities broke official guidance rules. Israel's on the verge of settling a new government after Labour agreed to join the right-wing coalition led by Benjamin Netanyahu. The Labour leader, Ehud Barak, will become the new defence minister, while the far-right Avigdor Lieberman will be foreign minister. But many Labour MPs are still opposed to their party joining the coalition. A UN warning has been given about Darfur after the Sudanese government's expulsion of aid agencies. A joint UN-Sudanese report said that more than 1 million refugees in Darfur will be without food within a month. The government told the main international agencies to leave after the president was indicted for war crimes. The common story on the morning front pages is the Bank of England's warning to the government. As the Times puts it, bank to Brown, stop spending. The Telegraph version is caution, no more tax cuts, while The Guardian chooses bank chief, UK cannot afford budget giveaway. The Mail, however, believes that the bank and Number 10 are at war, saying it's an unprecedented move when the bank warns Brown we can't afford budget spending spree. The Financial Times says that the bank believes the government cannot afford a second fiscal stimulus. The Guardian's found another financial story for its front page, telling us that Barclays' boss suffers massive pay cut to a mere £17 million. This is the worst that Bob Diamond, head of the Barclays investment arm, has experienced. He also paid out bonuses to his staff, £600 million worth, which he's called incentive compensation. Several papers put the British couple, who are victims of a pirate attack off Thailand, on their front pages. Murder by pirate, says The Mirror. Thai horror, writes The Express. The Telegraph describes the eight-hour ordeal of the woman whose husband was killed while she was tied up naked on their yacht, which they've been sailing around the world for the last 10 years. Finally, The Express leads on a medical study about men's prostate cancer. Only fish can stop cancer, it says, explaining that eating oily fish with its omega-3 oil can help men survive the disease. There's more on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
Last year, Ed Balls, the Children's Secretary, ordered a review of the curriculum used by primary schools in England. It's being conducted by the former Ofsted chief, Sir Jim Rose. The Guardian has seen a draft version of the new primary school curriculum, and Polly Curtis, our education editor, has the details.
What they've done is they've taken the 13 subject areas and reorganised them into 6 areas of learning. And in doing that, they've stripped out all the prescription in the curriculum. So the prescription that you have to learn the Victorians or the Second World War, or you have to be able to name all the places on a map. It takes out all that prescription and suggests what the key skills children should have at the end are, and the key abilities. So in history, it's about being able to source materials and describe chronological events, but it doesn't put the onus on the school to follow a set of instructions about which periods in history to teach. And the idea behind that is that the curriculum's been so cluttered that teachers haven't been able to teach any of it effectively, and a lot of that is then repeated at secondary school as well. So it's been a bit of a mess, really. It's not been very rational, and this gives a lot more freedom back to teachers to decide what to teach and when to their pupils in their specific set of circumstances.
Just to clarify, it doesn't mean that school children won't be learning at primary level about the Victorians or the Second World War.
No, that's right. I mean, it's absolutely up to the teachers which ones, what to teach when, and what's most relevant to their kids at that point in time. And, you know, those things are on the curriculum at secondary school as well. So what it does away with is the situation where you have kids learning the Second World War 3 times in their school career, you know, and instead at primary school, they're really getting the basics right. And hopefully without all that prescription, there will be a much more kind of dynamic, exciting kind of education between a teacher and the class.
And what about the emphasis on chronology? What do you make of that?
Well, I think it might have been thrown in there to make the point that they're not scrapping history and they're not removing kind of historical fact by putting this emphasis more on skills and on flexibility. So I think it might be a bit of a concession to traditionalists who might be quite outraged by the Victorians being removed from the curriculum. Or
And we're also going to see the introduction, the formal introduction into classrooms of social media and new media, such as Wikipedia and Twitter. How's that going to work?
In the English language and communication section of learning, there's a very, very strong emphasis on computer skills, on web-based skills, and it explicitly mentions Twitter and Wikipedia as both ways of communicating and ways of finding things out. And this is something that kids are already doing. So in a way, it's the curriculum catching up with children. But right from the very beginning of primary school now, there will be an emphasis on children being able to surf the net, for example.
Polly Curtis, and there's more at guardian.co.uk/education. Also on The Guardian's website today, several schools in Yorkshire have been handing out lines to parents parking in illegal places during the school run. They're having to write things like, "I will not park in a position that endangers school children." Stuart Jeffries reminisces on the lines he was made to write as a schoolboy, and he wonders if it helped discipline him. Guardian.co.uk/education. Sir Alan Sugar is interviewed by Sam Wollaston at Guardian.co.uk/media, and Marcus de Sortoy on the numerology of trillions. Guardian.co.uk/G2. Gordon Brown is in New York today. From there, he'll fly to Brazil and then Chile as he prepares the ground for next week's summit of G20 leaders in London. Yesterday, the Prime Minister addressed the European Parliament in Strasbourg. Our chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, says it was an uncharacteristically pro-European speech from Gordon Brown.
He said that he's proud that the British Parliament ratified the Lisbon Treaty. That wasn't welcomed by Nigel Farage, who's the leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party. And he said that Britain joined in the centre of Europe, not in Europe's slipstream, but firmly in its mainstream. Can't think who that was a dig at. Obviously, that was a dig at David Cameron, because last week the Conservative leader announced that after the European parliamentary elections in June, the Tories will pull out of the centre-right EPP-ED grouping in the European Parliament. They'll form their own group. and Gordon Brown didn't say it directly, but what he believes is that that will reduce, obviously, Conservative influence, but it will reduce British influence because the EPPED grouping is the largest grouping in the European Parliament. So there was Gordon Brown saying, we are right at the heart of Europe.
How do you account for this sudden outburst of pro-Europeanism from Gordon Brown?
Well, it's interesting that Gordon Brown is now wrapping himself in the European flag because he got a bit of a reputation when he was Chancellor of the Exchequer of not exactly being wildly keen on the European Union. He would famously often not turn up to the ECOFIN meetings of finance ministers, and when he did turn up, he wouldn't put on the headphones so he couldn't understand when anyone else was not speaking English. And he would also have a habit of briefing British newspapers that he was going to deliver a tough message to European finance ministers and then would say nothing the next day. So he has a bit of a reputation as a Eurosceptic. He clearly, as Prime Minister, takes a different perspective, believes that Britain's role should be at the heart of Europe. And particularly in the context of the run-up to the G20 summit next week, he believes that Europe needs to act as one, because acting as one, it'll be a more powerful force. And also he believes that Europe and the United States need to work together, because if there's transatlantic cooperation, then that is obviously a very significant force.
Well, as you say, the G20 summit next week, he's on this whistle-stop tour of the world. He's going to Strasbourg, New York, Brazil and Chile before the summit. You're going with him, Nick. What do you think the British hopes are for G20?
Well, I think the purpose of this trip is really for the Prime Minister to touch base with some pretty significant people ahead of the summit next week. He'll be meeting President Lula of Brazil, who is really one of the most significant leaders of the countries that are just outside the G8, but very much in the G20. In Chile, he'll be attending the Progressive Governance Conference that will have leaders from the progressive side of politics, as they would like to see it, from across the world, including Joe Biden from the United States. So it's a good chance to touch base with them to sort of clear the lines ahead of next week. In terms of their ambitions at the summit next week, well, British officials are very much downplaying any expectation of some major breakthrough at the summit in London. They're talking about this is not the sort of rabbit out of the hat sort of summit. It's the sort of summit where you make progress, steady progress, and they're saying that we'll be able to judge how successfully we're doing, not on April the 2nd or indeed April the 3rd the following day, but in the months ahead. Now, some people, Downing Street, would like us to believe that that is them sort of explaining the difference, if you like, between the G20 and the G8. They're different bodies. The G8 can come up with an action plan, more difficult for the G20 to do that. But there are differences and there are difficulties. Obviously, Gordon Brown had been hoping, along with the White House, that there may be agreement for another coordinated global fiscal stimulus. Their view is that if the world acts together in terms of a fiscal stimulus, you can triple or quadruple its effect. But the White House would like to do that. Downing Street would like to do that. But there is opposition in other European countries, most notably over the weekend from Angela Merkel in Germany. And so they are very much having to play down their expectations.
Nicholas Watt. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, why a milder climate is attracting the long-tailed tit to British gardens.
The milder conditions have meant that their food has been slightly easier to find and therefore they're having a higher survival rate.
First, remember Nudge? Well, this time last year it was much talked about, hugely influential with the Conservatives, but also with Barack Obama. The neat idea behind the book, Nudge, by the American economists Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein, is that small prompts can produce radical changes in behaviour. So by changing choice architecture and clever use of defaults, people can be steered towards decisions that will benefit themselves and the wider society. Well, you might think that Nudge was a bit, well, last year, given the recent upheavals in the world's economy, but a new paperback edition includes a postscript on the subject of the financial meltdown, and its ideas are more relevant than ever. Cass Sunstein is working for Obama, and Richard Thaler met Cameron and George Osborne in London yesterday. Thaler told me how his ideas helped explain what went wrong.
Well, I think that human frailty played roles at two levels. You can think of it as at the top and the bottom of the food chain. So at the bottom, it's probably not surprising to remark that the people who took out the subprime mortgages that created this mess, many of them didn't understand the intricacies of the mortgages that they were taking out. And like I say, that's probably not a very remarkable comment. But I think what's true is the complexities at the top were also befuddling to the people at the top who were making millions of dollars. So we've seen many companies disappear or virtually disappear. And I think partly that's because the CEOs of those companies weren't fully aware of all the bets that their employees were taking.
And there was also the temptation to take out a second mortgage. And there's plenty of opportunity for people to get heavily in debt.
Well, that's right. And I think temptation, again, played roles at the top and at the bottom. So refinancing your house became tempting when your neighbor did and used the proceeds to add a room or buy a new car. And so there was a lot of keeping up with the Joneses. But there was just as much keeping up with the Joneses among the CEOs. So one bank CEO goes out and plays golf with another, and the one's bragging about how he's making hundreds of millions on credit default swaps, and the other one says, well, gee, I ought to get in on that too.
You say in the book that the proper response to the global financial crisis shouldn't consist solely of nudges, but what role can nudges play?
One idea from the book that's gaining a lot of currency now is to use more technology by making the disclosure that's now part of our regulation, transforming that to electronic disclosure. Here's the way it would work. When you apply for a mortgage, now you get 20 pages of unintelligible gibberish. Under the system we imagine, you'd get that, but in addition, you'd get an electronic file that you could download or upload into a website that would explain it to you. And it's difficult to do that. Translating 20 pages of text into information is hard. But if the information was machine readable, then websites could emerge that would help you. And we imagine the same thing for cell phone plans, for credit cards, and all kinds of things. So the idea is just to make the consumers smarter and help them make better decisions.
Another big development since Nudge was first published last year is the election of Barack Obama. And your co-author, Cass Sunstein, now heads the Obama administration's Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. What's your understanding of how the Obama administration uses choice architecture?
I've been referring to Cass as the nudger in chief. And I don't think that's his official title, but I'll give you a couple examples. The second day Obama was in office, there was an executive order released saying that the default option for the government is to grant all requests for information. So our big campaign for transparency is one that Obama agrees with. And since the government has much of the data that we'd like, saying that they're going to release it is a great first move. More recently, they announced a new plan where all companies have to publicize their carbon emissions. And this is something we talk about in the book, that merely publicizing that can have an effect, a good effect, because companies may be embarrassed about how much they're polluting the economy, or their neighbors will nudge them to clean up their act once they're made public.
Richard Thaler, and you can hear a longer version of that interview today at guardian.co.uk/audio. And Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth and Happiness by Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein is published by Penguin.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Just a quick mention that you can follow Guardian Daily and our preparations for it at twitter.com/guardiandaily. In Mexico, about 20 people are killed every day in violence between rival drug cartels that the government of President Felipe Calderón has seemed powerless to stop. Joe Tuckman reports from Culiacán.
The sound of a shootout in broad daylight in Culiacán, the sweltering capital of the Mexican Pacific Coast state of Sinaloa, and one of the main fronts in the blood-curdling war between rival cartels and between them and the government. Well over 5,000 people died in the conflict across Mexico last year, about a fifth of the total in Sinaloa, and most of those in Culiacán.
The people have fear. I have fear. All the people have fear.
As a reporter for a local newspaper, Juan covered much of last year's bloodshed. He asked to be transferred to a more mundane beat after his brother was killed by a stray bullet when gunmen sprayed a volleyball court with machine gun fire.
I can't explain what I feel, but it's terrible, it's espantoso.
For Dr. Antonio Gonzalez, reducing risks means asking ambulances not to bring the wounded to the private clinic that he runs. He made the decision after a man whose brains were visible through his shattered skull was brought in by relatives who refused to believe that he was dead.
They made me put a drip in the corpse and pretend to resuscitate him. They beat me up. Later I found out that the husband of one of the women there, a big fish, had been killed 3 or 4 months previously. He was brought to the clinic too, alive but dying. When the doctors told the people with him he was dead, they had the doctors and nurses on the floor with guns, threatening to kill them because the guy had died. That's why I told the Red Cross not to bring us gun wounds anymore.
Turf wars between Mexican cartels are nothing new, but nobody has ever seen anything like the orgy of extreme violence that began last year. Things got so bad earlier this year in Ciudad Juarez across the border from Texas that the only way the government found of bringing the killing down was to impose a de facto martial law in the city. The spiral of violence was triggered by President Felipe Calderón's unprecedented attempt to crack down, and the backlash, his government insists, is a sign of desperation on the part of the cartels as they fight over reducing spoils. But this argument hasn't calmed nerves in Washington, which has suddenly woken up to what is happening over its southern border, sending Hillary Clinton down here this week and booking in President Obama for April. It is also a logic that has never convinced many in the battlefront cities like Culiacán.
Lo cierto es que Calderón inicia una guerra y no sabe cómo, no sabe con qué, no sabe contra quién está peleando.
The thing is that Calderón started a war without knowing how to fight it, what to fight it with, or who he is fighting against. And that has generated a problem of governability for the first 2 years of his government, with the additional element that he was losing the war, or he certainly isn't winning it. Despite the huge resources dedicated to the war, there's not been a major damage to the structure of narco-trafficking.
Ismael Bojorquez edits a tiny investigative Culiacán-based weekly called Rio Doce, which walks a fine line between revealing the on-the-ground realities of the drug wars and putting its reporters in serious danger. As the so-called cradle of Mexican drug trafficking and the birthplace of most of today's kingpins, Sinaloa is a particularly good place to explore how both the narcos and their wars have become inextricable from everyday life. Take the 24-hour tire-changing workshop that Mario runs.
Pues la llantera se llevaba llena de carros. Llegaban.
The workshop was always full of brand new cars, Hummers, BMWs, the most luxurious cars there are. Inside them, some of the narcos kept their weapons discreetly out of sight, while others would come in with Kalashnikovs at the ready. But since the army operations and the war between the traffickers started, the workshop is empty. Business dropped by 70%. The thing is that lots of traffickers have been killed, and those that haven't are lying low or have left the city. And all of that is bad for business.
Mario isn't comfortable with his dependence on traffickers, but it isn't hard to find those who are. Jacqueline lives next door to a house where a four-hour gun battle left 7 police officers and just 1 narco dead. She rattles off a list of acquaintances who have lost their lives in other incidents in the war as if it were gossip, but gets evidently angry when she thinks about the belt tightening that has accompanied it all.
Felipe Calderón has left us in ruin. This idea of going after the narcos has left us without any money in Culiacán. We were fine before the president started doing his stuff. Say what you like, but the narcos help us in Culiacán. The government does nothing.
Joe Tuckman reporting. Back in January, more than 500,000 people took part in the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds annual survey, the Big Garden Bird Watch. And the numbers of 9 out of the top 10 birds that were spotted increased slightly compared with last year. The RSPB's Gemma Rogers says that for the first time, the long-tailed tit made it into the top 10.
A long-tailed tit is often considered one of the most beautiful garden birds. So it's a lot like some of the rest of the tit family, like the blue tit and the coal tit, in that it's one of the smaller birds, similar size to a sparrow, but it literally has a long black tail. And it's a really pretty bird. And we're seeing more and more of them on our feeders and tables, which a few years ago we wouldn't have seen so many.
And why has the long-tailed tit become a more frequent visitor to British gardens?
Well, there's a few theories. I mean, the main one is probably the fact that, believe it or not, today, as it appears to have gone really cold again, we have actually had some mild winters leading up to this year. And long-tailed tits are traditionally insect-eating birds, so they're particularly susceptible to the cold because the food they rely on, i.e. the insects, can be quite hard to find when, you know, the ground's frozen over or it's covered in snow or whatever. So the milder conditions have meant that their food has been slightly easier to find, and therefore they're having a higher survival rate.
So global warming?
Possibly, yeah. I mean, it's certainly a sign of changing weather and possibly one of the symptoms of climate change. It's perhaps a bit early to say that climate change is responsible for more long-tailed tits in our garden, but it could certainly be a factor. And also, over the last 10 years, the long-tailed tit has sort of adapted to feeding on seeds and peanuts and on bird tables and hanging feeders. So a few years ago, it would have been quite unusual to see them on a feeder because they'd have been foraging in the countryside for the insects. But the behaviour of coming to tables and feeders has almost kind of spread throughout the species. So, you know, I guess a group of them sort of came to feeders, learnt the benefits, you know, began to realise that all the food they were finding in these places was really good for them and easy to come by. And it's kind of grown throughout the species. So that might be another reason why we're seeing more of them.
The most common bird was still the sparrow. Does that mean that reports of its decline are exaggerated?
Yeah, the house sparrow was number one for the sixth year running, I believe. And people often find it hard to believe for that reason that actually the house sparrow's in serious decline. Actually, since the survey began 30 years ago, the house sparrow's declined by over 60%, which is a huge drop in numbers and obviously very worrying. So although we do still see a lot of them, over the last 30 years they've dropped considerably. And this is obviously something we're worried about, and we need to try and do more to help them.
And the numbers of the second and third place birds in the survey, starlings and blackbirds, have also fallen over the 30 years of the survey.
Yeah, the starlings, another one. Actually, the starlings, I believe, suffered the biggest decline of all garden birds in the 30 years that we've been carrying out this survey, which has dropped by almost 80%, which, you know, is absolutely incredible, and it's horrible to think. But yes, despite the fact that it's still number two, it's over 30 years we've lost an awful lot in numbers of starlings.
Were there any surprise visitors to UK gardens?
Well, I mean, a few years ago, all people really put out, and this was absolutely right, was, you know, bags of peanuts. We weren't particularly creative with the things that we put out. And over the last few years, people have not only become more aware of the different foods they can put out, but they also seem to really enjoy it, which is absolutely fantastic. And I think that as a result of putting more and more different foods out and doing it regularly, we are seeing an even bigger variety of birds than ever before. So we're, you know, they're paying us back, basically, which is brilliant. So, I mean, a great example this year was we saw quite a lot of waxwings, which are beautiful birds, and last year they were at number 72 and this year they were at 59. So you know, certainly some of the more unusual visitors do seem to be coming to our gardens more and more.
And 500,000 people took part in this year's survey, including my stepson, actually.
Excellent.
There's a lot of people interested.
Yeah, this year we had two reasons to celebrate the Big Garden Bird Watch. Not only was it the 30th year of the survey, but also a record-breaking amount of people took part. So well over 500,000 people took part this year, which is brilliant, not only from a data collection point of view, but it also means that that many people felt compelled to do their bit for garden wildlife and obviously enjoy, you know, looking at it, watching what they're seeing in their gardens. So yeah, hopefully long may it continue.
Gemma Rogers from the RSPB. Peter Sale and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.